Hey, good evening, everyone. John Henry Soto here, along with George Batista. Welcome to Counterparts Bronx Edition. This is actually part two. And the reason we did a part two, or we're doing a part two, we might even do a part three, depending on how this goes, was because of how well part one went. And we'll tell you more about that en un segundo. All right, welcome everyone. John here, George over there, and we had a show last week or 2 weeks ago maybe, and it was about the Bronx, and we thought, you know, let's talk about where we grew up, our experiences. I showed a building, like my wife thinks I'm obsessed with this building that I grew up in. Yeah, I think I am obsessed with it. Someday I might actually try to buy that building. I know it was for sale recently, a couple of years ago.
Maybe, if you're going to be obsessed with something, it's not bad to be obsessed with a building.
Right? You know, right? Buy the building, make
I'm
it look
I'm addicted
nice.
To a building.
Yeah, I'm addicted to a building, you know? So, yeah, exactly. I could be like, where's my pipe?
Exactly.
You got issues, you know?
Hey, when that happens.
Yeah. But yeah, we had that show and we had a lot of engagement.
Yes.
You guys were like really involved. We had a lot of people making comments and talking, and we looked at the numbers later on, and I was like, wow, we got a lot of people commented. And then as the show was being shown later on, it actually also got more views, and some people were messaged saying, oh man, I missed the live for, you know, and I say, we're going to do another one. So hopefully they're here now. If you're out there and you missed part one, you can check out part one after we get done with part two, which we're in the middle of right now. But yeah, so we're going to talk today. We have we're going to talk about some Bronx facts, which I think last time was really interesting. There were a lot of things that I didn't know. George did some research on some stuff, so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about some music. We're going to talk about the music. George and I grew up in the Bronx listening to music that people from the Bronx generally would not be listening to. It was a strange situation. But we love our salsa. We love our Spanish music. We're going to talk about food, right? We have a little bit of a conversation about our food. That part of it might be a little bit challenging to get through, to be honest. So please bear with me because the food is amazing, but there are certain concerns. We're going to call them concerns that George and I have with our people.
And in part three, we're bringing a cardiologist on. So,
Bronx card. He's from the Bronx, from Albert Einstein Medical Center, and we're going to be talking about what are you doing? That's what it's called.
Exactly.
Get to ase. So, George and I grew up. I think George. I think I'm four years older than you, approximately, right? Something like that.
Something like that.
4 years. So we were close enough in age, and I was immature enough, and he was mature enough, where we kind of met, and we played music at a young age, and we got good fairly quickly, I would say, right?
Yes.
Like within 6 months or something.
Yeah, it was
us not playing, and then we just got a huge improvement because we played every single day, right. And we just put in all those hours, and the music that we were listening to was really. To me, it was really interesting because we both grew up in an era where rap was, right? It was called rap, or actually it was called being an MC at first, right? It was like
correct
the MC on the mic, right?
Correct.
And then it became rap,
right?
And you know, now it's hip hop, right?
Right.
And you know, being around the birth of that, I remember, and I don't know when was your first time remembering it, but I remember walking on the street and there was this kid on his stoop with like some other kids and stuff. And he was doing this thing. Yeah, girl, yo, you know, with it, cause I'm the man, you know, I was like, and I remember being mesmerized by what he was doing. Cause that was the first time that my ears had listened to this kind of communication in this way.
Right.
And so I remember just being mesmerized and I was like, what is that? You know? And that was early on. And then a few years later, when I was actually able to kind of go out and hang out, I was at this block party. And back in the days, we had block parties where, you know, the light poles, you know, those light posts at the bottom. If you open up the light post gently with a crowbar, you can actually go and plug in equipment. And so a lot of DJs would just have these big block parties and plug in their equipment on these poles. Now, the police, the cops, they were busy trying to handle, you know, crime and like severe, you know, serious issues. They were not messing really with the DJs and doing the block parties. Now, they did have to show up because sometimes the knuckleheads show up at block parties and they try to start trouble and whatever. But it was a lot of fun.
And they asked you to leave, so it was good. It was good.
Yeah, no, it was good. I left. I mean, I was like, listen, I'm gonna take this hat and I'm leaving. That's right. That's how long I've had. I've had this hat for. No, actually, this was a new thing. But so this guy got on the mic, and his name was. If Baby Spoon is still out there, his name was Baby Spoon. That was his name, and he was so smooth. He reminded me years later on of a Snoop Dogg,
right?
Like how Snoop Dogg is like so smooth and stuff.
Yeah.
And he reminded me of Snoop Dogg and like an Eminem flavor, you know. But he was really, really cool. And and then they would record, you know, people would show up with like boom boxes and record the thing. So then the next day we would be able to hear it again, you know, and he was just with beats, you know, it was just beats. And he was just like doing his thing and that was the first time that I ever heard an MC. I'm the MC on the mic, tell you your name, and you know, and that kind of stuff. And it was really mind blowing. And then I don't know if you remember, George, WBLS.
Oh, of course. BLS. Yes.
So WBLS, before hip hop or before even the word hip hop was a thing. Go ahead, George.
No, I just want to make sure I piggyback on the let's stay on the hip hop topic for a second.
Yeah, I'm staying on there.
If you're staying on it, okay, then I'll follow whatever.
No, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that because obviously, well, for me, first of all, it was the Sugar Hill Gang. That's kind of what.
Right.
That, you know, I remember having that album.
Right. That was the first time it became mainstream.
It became mainstream.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. That's so kind I'm of even what, talking about before that. Even before no, that.
I mean, this was, yeah, I know
I'm talking old. About
before yeah. that, but I'm saying, but for me, that's kind of where it started for me as far as that goes. But we all know that the Bronx was the birthplace of hip hop.
That's right.
Okay. So
now, that becomes. Depending on where you are, it is very, very well documented. Established in the world of hip hop that is our argument. Now, other people can say that is, you know, like Michael Jackson did not invent the moonwalk. There's footage of dancers doing it in the 40s.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's not, but no one has really been able to battle or to say or to have any kind of proof that it wasn't. Because remember, we had the Sugar Hill Gang, you know, we had, but before that, we had Grandmaster Flash.
But before that,
KRS-One.
Without Grandmaster Flash, as you say that, because a lot of people kind of equate him with being, you know, I mean, he is kind of a pioneer, but he wasn't the first.
No, he definitely was not the first.
Okay, so. It's established, and again, I don't know if there's controversy on it, but I, you know, it's established that it was actually 1973 by a gentleman named Clive Campbell,
right,
who is known by as DJ Kool Herc,
right.
And reported
the documentary where they talk about him.
Correct. So reportedly, he hosted a party in the building at 1520 Sedgwick Avenue. And that's really where the birthplace of the hip hop sound and the rhythm started.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was there and I remember hearing the sounds, and like I was mentioning about WBLS in the evenings past midnight, because this wasn't mainstream. Nobody was interested in really, well, not that they weren't interesting. They just didn't know about it. It was still a new form of expression. And on WBLS, after midnight, there were battles. There were recorded battles, and there was the Cold Crush, Grandmaster Flash, Furious Five, Milli Vanilli. But I didn't think it came until later. No, but there were all these hip-hop these rappers that they would battle one another, and right. it was epic. And then whoever was able to capture it on their little, I always do this because this, you needed to press two buttons to record.
Record and play.
Record and play. So yes. I always do this.
Yes.
This means record.
Yeah.
So they, whoever had the best recorded version from that, well, the next day or the next weekend or the next week, whatever it was, when we were hanging out, they would be playing that. And that's what we would, that'd be the thing that we'd be listening to. We'd be like, oh, you know, because they'd be right. snapping at each other. It was a battle. Rabbit. But of course, it was all gentle battle. And it's not like today, I'm going to kill you and shoot you in your head. It wasn't anything like that. It was just like, yeah, I got more money than, and my girls like me more, and you know, that kind of stuff. It was, you know, they did talk about the streets, and they did talk about how rough things. And I think when Grandmaster Flash and came out with, you know, broken glass everywhere, people are pissing on the steps. Oh, I can't say pissing. I can say pissing, right? It's our show. Pissing on the steps, like they don't care. Anyway, that whole scene, that was like a very, very dark.
Yes.
Representation of the Bronx put to music, but it was like such a smack in the face when I heard it for the first time, because one, it was such a cool song.
Right.
You know, it was particularly, broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stairs, like they just don't get, you know, and it was like, and you know, when you first hear it, you're like, oh my God, they're talking about us.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about what our experience, but they're putting it out in such creative and musical way, you know. And you know what goes through my mind, I remember thinking, man, this is going to impact the world.
Wow.
Because people are going to hear this, and more people are going to start getting influenced by it and want to actually communicate their experience through this, you know. Right. What I mean, and that is what's happening. That is still going on, although it's gotten very commercial now, and it's all about the 4-minute song about disrespecting someone, which I don't, you know, I like old school hip hop. You know, I like the messages. I like fight the man. You know what I mean? You know, all that stuff is really still really what it was for me. That was powerful.
I agree.
I'm trying to think of it. It was Grandmaster Flash, Furious Five. Sugar Hill Gang, of course. I mean, they were the first that became where people were like, oh, we can make money off of this?
Yeah, Melly Mel.
Yeah, and all those guys were, Melly Mel. You know, they just, of course, you know, it's as soon as money is made or there's possibility of money being made, then you had the whole thing happen, like in the 80s, I guess. You had the Run DMCs and LL Cool J. What's the other? I mean, there's just so many of these guys. I remember at that period of time, I remember somebody was being interviewed, and they said that Run DMC are sort of like the Beatles of hip hop, and LL Cool J is sort of like the Elvis of hip hop for that period of time. For that period of time, you know, because remember, there was a small period of time. It might have been like a year that summer. It was just like Run DMC was it.
We were all, especially when they did that whole thing with Aerosmith and then
and that came later.
But it became it put them even more, you know.
Right. Yeah. And that became that was where the money part, where people realized, oh, we can make money. Right. Remember, they came to him with an Aerosmith song saying, hey, you guys should do this song. And they're like, we'll do our own material. We're not gonna
do our material.
But you know, they saw the potential of unifying these two genres, which turned out to be humongous, you know.
Yep.
But even before that, you know, it's like that, you know, and that's the way it is. That stuff, when that came out, it was, and then people would just take the beats and just and somebody would come and do an MC, you know, and rap over that.
Exactly.
And that era, I mean, that whole, those 2 years that I can recall, I guess I was probably 14, I would say, you know, 14, 15, 16. It was those that block of time. And it was just, and breakdancing was also really a
popular. I was going to ask you, is that the breakdancing years? Is that those?
Yeah, I wasn't going to talk about my breakdance.
Come on, man.
But yeah, that was definitely the breakdance years. And I've talked about it before. I did a thing about it. I mean, yeah, you know, that was luckily, you know, a lot of people didn't have cell phones Nobody had a cell phone. Nobody could record. There's no footage of me, as far as I know.
Damn it.
Doing it. I know. I was like,
no. You know, I remember
there are video cameras and people that did record stuff, but who knows where those are.
I do remember when I was young. I mean, I guess it was around that time. You came to my grandmother's house once with a friend, and it was you came with, I mean, literally with the hat, with the gloves, with the whole thing.
The whole breakdancing.
And outfit. I'm I guess maybe you're 14 and I'm 10 or 9, yeah. And I'm going, holy cow, what happened? I'm like, look at him. Then I was like, he's so cool.
Not everyone was saying that.
Yeah, I know.
But the one thing that I do remember about that time, and in retrospect, you know, I did take it for granted at the time because I didn't know what was happening. You know, it was just something that we did.
Yeah.
But we danced. There was about 10 of us that were together, and we danced for like the mayor. You know, Mayor Koch would come a couple of times. We did dances for one of the Placido Domingo came to like one of the centers, and we did a dance for them. We won like a WBLS contest, and they wouldn't allow more than 5 people in a group, and there was 10 of us. Right. So we just split ourselves up and changed the name of one, and we won first and second place. So it was cool. So we were like really. At the time, doing really, really well. And, you know, there was Rocksteady was the popular, yes. You know, they were really popular. They were getting commercial work.
Right.
You know, we were out there dancing, and we were, and then Harry Belafonte opened up, produced a film called Beat Street.
Yes, I remember that. Beat Street, the king.
And there was a club called the Beat Street opened up shortly after that because of the film. And then I actually auditioned and became a Beat Street dancer. I was like a Beat Street dancer for maybe like 6 months or something. And I'd go there, and the whole premise was that groups would come and challenge the Beat Street dancers.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Now we were good, but there were guys out there that were like mass, like really good, you know. Luckily they never showed up. So everybody who came, we took care of, but it was, but you know, another thing that I remember kind of like taking for granted was I would go to almost every club. I never paid for anything. I never paid to get into Funhouse, First Class, Skate Key, that on Fridays and Saturday nights became a dance hall.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever the other ones, Devil's Nest was another one. Never paid. I would show up, and because I was a unique looking person, I'm short. I always had facial hair, like, you know, interesting facial hair. And I had my outfit. They would just see me, and the bouncers would be like, yo, come on, shorty. Come on, shorty. You can come in. You can come in. And the reason for that was because people would come to see the dance, to see the break dancers and compete and all that stuff. And I just thought it was a normal thing. Like, oh, yeah, that's the guy that I know.
Right.
He's going to let me in. There's a whole line of people waiting, and I just go right in like nothing. And it was just an interesting time to be alive, to experience that birth of hip hop within that whole scene, you know, because it was a big scene. I mean, it was and it's still going on now. I mean, I look at these breakdancing, they have these world competition breakdancers now.
Yo, yeah, off the charts.
These guys phenomenal. I mean, we were like impressed with a really good backspin and windmills and stuff like that, but these guys are doing things now that are acrobatic, like literally Olympic quality stuff, you know.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Isn't breakdancing like in the Olympics now or something like that?
The moves are. I know that a lot of the moves that I saw in gymnastic on floor,
right?
They did a lot of stuff that I remember. It kind of bleeding into that because
maybe
it was in there. Maybe we took it from there. I don't know how that went, but. I know I took notice of it later on where I saw them doing breakdancing moves.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's something we do, you know. So I don't know if it was something we took or they took, but I don't know if it's an Olympic sport. It's a very difficult thing to make into an Olympic sport because of how different, I mean, no, not different, how similar the dance styles are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there would have to be some criteria written down of what's the perfect windmill. Legs extended,
right?
No opening of the legs. You know, we knew that. So then that would have to be, And then you kind of then take the fun out of the fact that it's a dance that's spontaneous and you do whatever you, you know, you kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, but wouldn't, isn't that kind of like the, what they do in like the floor exercise of gymnastics,
correct.
Right? A person has to have a perfect
correct.
Whatever in order yeah. to, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying, that, you know, when you're dancing, you're not really thinking about, I got to have my legs extended perfectly, you know what I mean? But then if it becomes a thing, if it yeah. becomes a dance, you
yeah,
know,
you have to
it's sort of like championship dancing, like tango dancing or right. salsa dancing competitions. They're all over the world, these huge, giant competitions, you know. Right. Conferences like that. I just saw one. I follow a couple of dancers, salsa dancers and stuff, like this husband and wife team that they travel the world. And it's amazing how popular salsa is all over the world, you know, and right. there's huge conferences.
Mm-hmm.
There, you have to do the steps. Everything has to be on time. You got to be, the timing has to be perfect. Everything has to be, because that's what the judges are looking for. Exactly. With breakdancing, the people that do breakdancing are not thinking with that. They're thinking with, let me get this move down to beat that move that guy just did,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is.
Right.
You know, and there's so many moves that then you have to, you know, like when you're doing the bars, the two bars, the
yes.
parallel, there's certain right. moves that you have to do.
Correct.
Right, you yes. have to do them.
Right. Right.
So, like, what's it going to be? You know, it's like, okay, well, you have to do a head spin, you have to do a back spin, and then after that, you can be a little more creative. You know, I don't know. It could be, but it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. You know what I mean? And I loved it, and I became a ghetto celebrity. You know, and I remember being on waiting for the subway train and hearing like, that's the guy that breakdances. You know, and hearing that and being really awkward with that. And, you know, you're 16 years old, 15 years old, and all you're thinking about is like get into that club because you want to hear the loud music and you want to dance.
Right.
You want to see who's there. And of course, even girls and all that stuff is part of the whole game. But the unfortunate thing about it is that, you know, it got associated with like gangs and stuff. And then there was like unfortunate incidences that occurred that I've spoken about on other episodes of just really bad things that have happened. People have died, you know, just wrong place, wrong time at a battle and stuff like that. And,
yep.
and you know, I did a lot of battles and I would literally be in my house and then people would be yelling at my name out the window. My mom would come, they're calling you. And I'm like, I look out the window, yo, that guy from Fox Street is here. He wants to battle. And I'm like, I don't want to do that now. He's like, come on, please, please, you got to come down.
You're like the Bruce Lee of breakdancing. Like they would challenge him every time he would say.
And one day, two quick stories, but one day that happened. They called me up and they want to battle for names. This was like a thing. And I was like, I don't really care. My name was Elek. Right, that was my name,
yes.
And it was a capital E with a little hyphen, LEC, and it was like for electric, and it was just E, like, I don't know, somebody gave me that name. And so they were like, so they people yelling Elek, I'm not even listening to that. Elek, I don't know what they're saying, you know, I don't respond to Elek, it was just, right. But I did have it on some clothing. So finally my mom is like, so I went down, and these guys from like Fox Street, I always remember that, and it was three of them. And they were called Snap, Crackle, Pop. That was their
okay.
That was their name. No. We adopted the name Snap, Crackle, Pop as a joke.
Okay.
A few days earlier. And then people were saying they want to battle you for names.
Right.
And the guy's name was like KK and or Kiki or something like that. And then these two other guys, and they wanted to battle for Snap, Crackle, Pop.
Okay.
And in my head, I'm thinking like, yeah, you could take it anyway. I'm not, that was a joke.
Right.
You know what I mean? We were just kidding. So they're like, they want that name. So they yell at me. So I go down and, you know, I put on my gear. Like a guy doing a windmill on my chest. No hair whatsoever. Smooth. And so I go down. And I see the guys and stuff, and two moves. I went in twice, and then one guy turned to the other guy and he was like, go ahead. And the guy was like, you go ahead. And of course, what happens in a battle, because if a lot of people go to battles, the circle already knows when someone hesitates.
Okay.
You know, if you hesitate, you lost.
Right.
If you're standing there waiting to go in and you're just like waiting for them to finish so you to go in, right, you're still in the game. Right. But if you go like, go ahead, you go, you're done. Because wow, then the whole crowd goes, ah, and they all start screaming. And that happened at Gate Key like a lot. Not just with me, but with like other battles that I was seeing and stuff. And so everybody yelled. So that was done. And then we were supposed to take their name, you know, and it was like a battle for names, you know. And I was like, and I told the guy later, I was like, I don't want your name. Dude, you could keep your name. I was like, I don't know which one I am, Snap, Crackle, or Pop. I was like, I don't know what the hell's going on here. And then another time, probably one of the highlights was when I took down five guys by myself at Skate Key, a big competition thing. And there were five guys. And I did, first it was just, you know, this stuff. Mm. And so I went in for that. Two guys were out and stuff, and they were like, oh, and they kind of went back. Another guy came down, and then he left. And then one guy started breakdancing, and I guess they didn't know. I know that I did that too. Then I went down, and the whole place goes, ah, crazy. And then when I got up again, none of them wanted to come out. And then that was it. And it's so cheesy to think of it now. But one guy like carried me. he's like, yeah,
Rocky.
Yeah, it was so, and I was like laughing, and you know, but it was so silly. But I was thinking at the time, I was like, you know, I was just enjoying the time. You know, yeah, what I mean, I was just like, I was enjoying that. I met a girl that night. It was a good couple of years. You know what I mean? And then the guitar was always like, you know, we should probably talk about the music.
Yeah, no, because I just wanted to mention that at that same time, I was battling with my G.I. Joes. They were, I was home battling with my G.I. Joes. You took your name. No, so I was doing that.
I'm G.I. Joe. I'm G.I. Jim.
Exactly. While you were
I'm battling. I'm G.I. George.
You were battling in the streets.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was one of those times when you really are not aware of even the environment that you live in,
right?
Because we were living in such a rough environment, you know what I mean, and buildings burning and drugs and all this stuff that was going on, but yet there was this other life, you know, there was this other protective life, mm-hmm, that you were just a dancer, you know what I mean, and you know, when we walked into places, you know, we were all dressed with, you know, our windbreakers with the white stripe, you know, the red suit with the white stripes, and with the whatever hats we were wearing, or the some people were wearing those do-rags on their heads and stuff. And, you know, you walk in as a group like that, you know, people, it draws attention, mm-hmm, you know, and it's a fun feeling because you're literally going in there just to dance.
Exactly.
Right. You know what I mean? Just to dance, you know, and you're just having a good time. And, you know, I did get to meet some of those Rocksteady guys, and they became very famous, you know, in within that world. Like, they were on all the movies, and they were like, and I would see them and stuff. And, you know, it was always like weird to me to be in a movie doing that, because I thought the movie's not going to, and it did happen. Like, I remember thinking in my head, you can't really carry a whole film with just breakdancing. It's got to be a really good story.
Right. Sure.
You know what I mean? And it just got to be a really good story. It can't just be about, and you know, those movies like Break In and Beat Street and other things that came out, you know, really did not have the really necessary story to have breakdancing as like maybe as a almost as a character within the story, mm-hmm, but not the focal point,
right?
You know, and it was really difficult to do that, and without actually also being depressing.
Yeah, of course.
Where everyone gets shot and everybody's on drugs and everything looks dirty and everything, you know, and it's like, well, you took away from breakdancing, in my opinion, you know what I mean? And I've had conversations about this throughout the years with guys from that era that are still friends of mine, that we still chat via Facebook and stuff. And, you know, we've chatted about it, and, you know, it just seemed like they didn't represent us properly during that time, you know, and we just got a bunch of movies about the worst part of the Bronx with a little breakdancing thrown in and stuff like that. And all the actors and everything was fantastic. It was great, you know, but not the best. They could have done better, George. If I talk like that, I'll get my ass kicked in the Bronx. But yeah, I would not be ignored. Kuriaki. That's one of the guys from Rocksteady.
Oh, God.
So that leads us to music because obviously I was involved in that really for the music. It was the music that I loved. I loved to roller skate, so I roller skated almost every weekend. I don't know where I got money. But I guess I didn't really get charged. I just needed to get there. the music for me was early on. You know what I mean? Like my grandparents had records and were listening to, actually I was named after, my nickname is Tito. And I was named after Tito Rodriguez. That was my grandmother's favorite singer. And Tito, he died young. As a matter of fact, I was watching this not long ago. He was about my age when he passed.
Really?
Yeah, I had no idea. For some reason, I'm thinking he was like 80, you know. But no, he was like a young guy. Not that I'm young, but I'm youngish. And, you know, I was really surprised that how popular. He was sort of like the Frank Sinatra of that type of bolero singer, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. bolero music and, ballads and stuff like that. And he was great, you know. So that was my grandmother had all his records. And whenever a new record come out, you would see it in her opening up the cellophane on the record and put it on. And of course, there was Tito Puente that was also very popular growing up. Celia Cruz, El Gran Combo, which was always around. Hector Lavoie. Jose Feliciano, which was like the first time I saw, him playing guitar. I was I could not believe he was doing this. Right. You know what I mean? Yep. And my grandfather would always call me whenever he was on, Tito, ven acá, Jose Feliciano. You know, and I was always running and watching. It was really that's what started me off.
Yeah, absolutely.
You
know? Absolutely.
Do you remember your first like music thing that you heard and you're just like, I like this.
Yeah, it's a little
air supply.
It's a little air supply.
Like lost in the world. Yeah.
To me.
Like, I like this song, mommy.
No, it wasn't air supply. It probably was a little more embarrassing than that.
Yeah, Barry Manilow. Although, I mean, Air Supply and Barry Manilow, two of my favorites.
Barry Manilow is
the Barry Manilow is awesome.
His melodies were amazing.
The dude is a master. People were always making jokes about that, and I remember being like,
I remember, right? My mother used to have one of the 12-inch of Barry Manilow, and it was him in the front like this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember that.
I just remember seeing that album all the time. And I was like,
my mom had that. My mom also had the Air Supply Greatest Hits.
Nice.
So we would always, you know, rock that. Kenny Rogers was big.
My mother had a stack of 45s. Yeah. And her favorites were like Paul Anka.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett. All those folks were in there. I think Air Supply was in there, too, actually. By the way.
It's got to be. I mean, they were huge. And they also, were huge, their melodies are incredible. And the guy, Russell, I can't remember his name, but his vocals are, like, insane. Yes. He had, like, a three-octave vocal, which was, like, you know, not many people do the three-octave. I mean, you were talking about Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, those kinds of, Adele. Can do those kinds of things, but man, and effortlessly. And you know that they're still touring?
Yes, I did hear that. I was shocked. I didn't even realize.
Yeah,
even
I know follow them on Facebook. Wow. And whoever does their social media every once in a while when they're doing a song, they'll go live and I get a notification.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes, I get a notification from Air Supply going live.
Okay, John. He went from hip-hop hero to Air Supply.
Yo, in the Bronx when I was like getting in the clubs for free.
To Air Supply in Nashville.
Oh, my. Have the tides turned.
Times have changed.
But, they're still great.
But anyway, for me, the way it started was much greater than Air Supply and all those good things. Was Kiss.
Kiss, yeah, no, that makes sense.
No, I had an obsession. It was
very, my brother.
They were as commercial as can be, right? They were just they were this marketing machine.
That's what it was.
It was a marketing machine. And I remember it was actually my cousin Julio, you know, him and I used to be obsessed, and we used to literally
paint their faces.
So, yes. So I did get the Kiss makeup kit for either our birthday or something.
Yeah, because I remember you were using your mother's makeup for a while, and that became very awkward at those gatherings.
Yes.
You're like, no, I'm Kiss.
And I still have it, by the way. I haven't thrown it away yet. but yeah, I used to have my relatives, like my aunts and stuff, they would paint my face as a certain Kiss person. And then I would take pictures as Ace Frehley or Gene Simmons or whatever. But anyway, the big thing that happened to me was the Kiss Alive 2 album.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's when my mother bought me, which is technically my first drum set, which was a little Muppet drum set. I was probably 6 years old, right? And I was doing Peter Criss's solo while playing the 12-inch of that thing.
Nice.
In an apartment, right? And that's
on Kermit's head.
But here's the funny thing, because that's one of the things that got me. And one of the discussions that we had before was when my parents were married, I used to go to bed listening to music. And
right.
Of course, I did it because I was drowning out my parents arguing.
Right.
But part of that also was getting so falling in love with music and the music. Yeah. And this was late 70s, right? Falling in love with this music and really get music getting into my brain, where I have developed this memory for music, which I still have, which is probably the only thing as a musician that's at a high level for me anyway. But that's really what started me. It was that plus Kiss. And I said, music is, you know, this, it just has to be a part of my life in some way. So that's kind of what started that whole thing for me.
Yeah. And I think I was telling you the other day when we were chatting about the transistor radio that my grandfather had. My grandfather was also very much into music and loved music. Didn't play any instruments, but my uncles did. And he loved the guitar, you know, and he loved music. So he had a lot of the 78s, you know, which were like thick. You can like literally kill somebody with a 78.
Right.
And he had all the records and stuff. And one of the things that was really that really impinged on me was hearing my uncles fixing guitars and then playing them. You know what I mean? Like, you know, my Tio Marcelo would come by and he'd have a guitar with no strings, no pegs, but he'd have little bags of stuff. And he'd be sitting there and he'd eat a big bowl of arroz con, you know, habichuela and chicken, whatever he'll eat. And then he just starts all working. And I'm just like watching him. And then I would kind of like be bored, you know, because he's like, I don't know. I don't even know what he's doing. And then in a few minutes I hear ting, tring, ting, 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 tring, you know, music. And I'm like, and I was blown. I was like, oh my God, that thing that he was building makes that. I was so blown away by that, you know? And so that was a big deal for me. But the transistor radio my grandfather gave me, you know, was my lifeline, you know, and I would listen to it to not so much just that I wanted to drown out your parents from fighting, because I could hear them.
I think everybody could hear them.
Yeah. No, but I was drowning out, you know, the television, the Spanish television, you know, whatever, and trying to sleep and stuff. But yeah, I was listening to it and I was obsessed with radio, and I still am to a certain degree. And it's kind of like, I just told George that I purchased it's right here, so I could actually show it, but it's how cheesy I am. But I did purchase a transistor radio, and it does have the whole antenna.
Amazing, huh?
I am a dork, but and I just love this sound. Listen to this. Isn't it the best?
Yeah.
And when you get that clear sound and you're like, ooh, I like this song, you know, and you're like,
so true.
It's like better than anything, you know.
I agree.
Yeah, so that was something. But the guitar, I got a guitar at the age of 9. I think I told the story last time, right?
Yeah.
But after that, I was learning to play, you know, here and there. And I think I learned to play the beginning of the solo for Hello, Is it me you're looking for? Whatever that solo was. Mm-hmm. So I learned to play bits and pieces of that, and I was very excited because it was just by ear. You know, I picked it up. But then I lost that guitar through circumstances of lifestyle changing. And when I heard for the first time Carlos Santana, it had the Latin thing that I kind of was in my mind, that it was like something that I'm familiar with, that I remember the Spanish. No, I'm on the show right now. Sorry. my son. It had the Spanish flavor of that I was used to listening to and to duplicating, but with this sustained heavy guitar, you know, that I just didn't understand for a while. I didn't really know what it was. I thought it was a keyboard, and you know, when I found out what it actually was, and I didn't find out through Santana, because remember, this we didn't have YouTube, people.
Yeah,
we didn't have any internet. If you wanted to see Carlos Santana in person, you would have to go see Carlos Santana in person.
Yep.
You'd have to go in concert or go find out where he lives. But you weren't. There was no other. And if he was on television, very rare would you see him on television. He wasn't going to do the Tonight Show. You know, the Tonight Show was not really meant for those kinds of acts. They were meant for more probably contemporary, I don't know, you know, Sinatra, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Tony Bennett and those guys, which I love too, you know. But it was watching PBS, and I think George and I are going to be doing a show on PBS in the future, because PBS came to life, and we're not going to go into it now because we are doing a show on that, but PBS did start for me right when I was born, right around that same time. And my grandmother heard that it was an educational thing, so she always would put it on for me, but she would forget to change it, so I'll end up watching McNeil, you know, Washington Week and McNeil Lair Report. And so I'm going to school and I'm like, did you hear the economy? It's like really struggling right now. What exactly is Jimmy Carter doing here? I mean, he seems to be the worst until. So we didn't really have cable. We didn't have any sources to really listen to these guys. But PBS would have these concerts, you know. And I remember seeing Peter, Paul, and Mary, James Taylor, Bruce Springsteen, and then a guy that from Seattle that became very famous in England that played, that was left-handed, Jimi Hendrix came on. And that was the first time that I heard that. And then I duplicated. I was like, oh, that's what that is. That's the guitar. I didn't know about the wah pedal. I didn't know anything specific, but I said, okay, that's what that is. You know, and then all hell broke loose after that. All I wanted to do was just that. Yeah. You know, I just wanted to figure that out. You know, and do you remember your first drum set? I was there for.
Yes.
Right. We'll probably do a series of just Bronx episodes. But let's
you know, we talk about the Bronx.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Well, all of this is happening in the Bronx.
It happened in the Bronx.
Right? All of this, that we're talking about is the Bronx. Yeah, this is the Bronx tale, our version of it. But let's go into some stats, some findings that you have, and then maybe we can break off into some stuff. If anybody has any questions about the Bronx, or if you're from the Bronx, or if you ever been to the Bronx, or if you ever wanted to go to the Bronx, drop us a line, a message.
I can tell you the good places to eat. And the places to avoid. But here's one interesting one, John. Do you know, I think I'm saying it right, the Morrisania?
Sure.
And Morris Avenue?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So they get their names from the Morris family of the Bronx, of which Lewis Morris was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Do you know, I do know this. You know why? Because there are in near where my sister still lives in the Bronx, there's a cemetery.
Correct.
That has two of the Declaration of Independence signers.
Yes.
One is Morris, and the other one is Tony Orlando.
Right. St. Anne's Church.
That's it, Tony. I like how you were just like.
It was like one of those boomerang things that came back. Tony
Orlando. Yeah, he wrote it. He signed it, knock three times on the ceiling.
St. Anne's Church. Uh-huh. On St. Anne's Avenue and East 142nd Street in Mott Haven.
That's it. Mott Haven, that's where my sister lives.
Yes. So that's, you know, that's, I didn't know.
There's
that.
History, yeah.
There's definitely history there.
Yeah, yeah. There's also a famous rock in near the Pelham Bay area, I believe mm-hmm. it is.
Yes.
Where George Washington right. had to regroup his troops in order to take Pelham, I believe.
Right, correct, or, correct. Right? Yes. And, yes.
Yeah. So that was actually, I remember going there. Remember, I rode my bike everywhere when I was.
Yes. You know,
so I would take my bike on different little things and I would see a lot of the Bronx, you know, and I would see places like that.
Yeah. Because they have the monument of George Washington standing next to Tony Orlando.
Right. Exactly. So- right. And then Dawn is right behind them. Yeah.
Another fun fact. Did you know, but that our little town of, well, not town, but little city, I guess, I don't know, whatever you call it, Co-op City.
Well, it's a city.
Is the largest housing complex in the nation.
Yes. Yeah. It was meant to be a revolutionary concept.
Right.
That was going to be implemented across the country and adapted, you know, everywhere.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, I've been to Co-op City many, many times.
Me too.
And unfortunately, it did not pan out the way they
nope.
the way they did, what they thought. I mean, remember, you purchased those.
Right.
You know, these are co-ops. Now, co-ops are different than condos. You know, I am a licensed real estate agent, so I can say this. Condos. You own
conspiracy.
No, it's true. They did land. A condo, you own everything from the paint in. Everything from the paint in, meaning that if you're in your house, you have to get permission, but you can actually put up a wall.
Right.
You own that. A co-op, you can't do anything.
Correct.
You only own a piece of the cooperation. It's right. a co-op and you own a tiny piece of it. Now, here's the thing. That cooperation collects dues.
Yes.
And those dues, monthly dues, go into a pot that get used to, you know, fix the community and to revamp right. things and to yes. expand it and to make things look pretty. So if that money is misused, which really rarely happens with humans, if that money gets misused in some way, or there's just not enough good policy, or maybe there's corruption. I know that's conspiracy.
Now, John, come on now.
No, I know.
You know, let's get real.
Corruption does not happen. That's no,
of
that's
course not.
But if for some reason at some point, maybe in the month of June for like a weekend, somebody did something that they shouldn't have done, then that would actually affect not only the whole cooperation, but every single individual that works there, now their property is worth less. That's why co-ops, I had an opportunity to actually sell a couple of them and I did not want to sell them. I would much rather sell somebody a condo that they actually own rather than a co-op. So, but anyway, Co-op City did not pan out the way we thought that it, or the way they thought that it did.
Correct.
Which is sad.
Yeah, it's sad, but.
But let me ask you this.
I got yes, sir.
One question.
Sure, you can ask me anything you like, sir.
So, what year was that?
No, I was 12, and I just stopped. Okay. I didn't know what I was doing.
They said it was candy.
Good.
So, what year? Do you remember what year that went up?
Let's see. Off the top of my head.
I thought you had it in front of you. I thought maybe
I do have it in front of me, but I have to read. I don't think it says actually in this piece here.
At a crack squad research center we got here. Crack squad.
Oh, listen, we would not have even gotten to this. So stop it. I'm still mad at you, by the way, because you keep dissing my facts from last time about the Hall of Fame.
I don't even remember. I did so many things. I dissed so many things. So don't know year. It's good. It doesn't matter. We don't.
Yeah, no. It's interesting though. It would be interesting.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I don't know if you remember Stevenson Common.
Of course, I remember Stevenson Common. I used to have family that lived there.
Correct. So we lived there for a little bit. And that was sort of like also a building that was sort of a revolutionary kind of a concept of an idea,
right?
Where there was all these complexes and the building, they had a security thing you had to go through, and you had to go through a turnstile to get into the building.
Well, I mean,
you know, all that stuff was, but then the quality of the service and servicing the people, you know, it just went down, and then it became like really a bad, we moved from there because it was so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of the issue with some of those areas and some of those, you know, things where it starts out as a great concept or, you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden it just completely, you watch it kind of disintegrate. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and I know people get mad at me for saying things.
What?
But
it's John Henry Soto at
ProtonMail.com. No, but I always say that it's the people. I mean, like I know
it is the people.
And I know that sounds like so silly to say, of course it's the people, but it's not just that it's the people, but it's also the building management not putting into its documents. Like I've done a lot of contracts and stuff, certain things that have to be met. Or you can be evicted, or you can be in trouble, or you have to pay a fine, or you have to, you know what I mean? Like these things were not put in because, you know, nobody there wanted to live in a neighborhood like that. You know what I mean? But if you allow, if you, and this is again where it gets a little controversial because we had Bobby Watts on a couple of days ago, right? Mm-hmm. And he was talking about subsidized housing, right? And how that comes about and stuff. And so, you know, a lot of these subsidized housings, unfortunately, if the management that's running them is not as strong, you know, as any other organization or company, you know, I mean, if they lack management skills, then what they do is they allow the tenants to run. Remember, they're renting. It doesn't matter if it's subsidized. You know, we rent here. In this, we're renting. When we moved here to Nashville, the only place we get is a little two-bedroom apartment. It's fantastic. We love it here. We're not complaining. But we are going to build something, and we want to do that in the next year, right?
Right.
But when I'm here, I make sure my kids don't scratch the walls. I make sure that because we don't own this building,
right?
Yeah, you know I mean, I don't want people to come in. And we didn't have a huge deposit here. This isn't like New York. Mm-hmm. Where you have a month's rent and a month's, but you know, there's nothing like that at all here. But I want, when I leave here, I want this apartment to look the way we moved in here because I'm respecting the fact that I do not own this. That is something that I think sometimes does not fully get duplicated, you know, and I grew up in the Bronx in a many buildings. So I'm talking from experience. I'm not talking from the guy living in a nice suburban community in Nashville now. I'm talking about when I was in the trenches and I was living there for most of my life, you know, I mean, I didn't get out of the Bronx, you know, or at least move out till I was like 24 years old or something.
But there's two concepts there. Okay. Because for you, for example, number one, you came in with the awareness, right? With that awareness that I have to respect the place. I'm respecting where I live.
Because my grandparents instilled that in me.
Correct. Exactly. So you came that was instilled into you. That's the first thing right there. And in a second, there is also this concept of renting versus owning, right?
Right.
When you own a house, there statistically you're usually going to keep that house in better shape.
Of course,
because you own it. It's an investment. It's your investment.
Right.
And which can lead to a return if you you know, if at some point you sell it down the line or whatever the case may be.
Correct.
So, you know, there's that. But again, it, that was instilled into you as just like as it's instilled to me. I lived in many apartments. I mean, I live in a home now, but through my childhood, all the way into my teenage years, you know this, we went from apartment to apartment to apartment.
Yeah.
In the Bronx. Okay. We went from Castle Hill Avenue. We went to all the way to Pelham Bay Park and all that. And, you know, I was taught you respect where you live. You respect it. Here's the interesting part for us. We moved, when we moved into Castle Hill, and John, you remember this, Castle Hill was predominantly an Italian neighborhood.
Yeah, it was actually a nice neighborhood.
It was a very nice neighborhood at the time. There was not that many stores.
You were on Chatterton, right?
Correct. We were on Chatterton. We were the first Hispanics to move into that place.
You ruined
it. And because
it's
of
that. It's your fault.
Correct. Yeah, it's my fault. I started the whole thing.
People would say.
But no, but the problem is the amount of racism
that
we experienced when we moved in there was ridiculous. And I'm 12 years old, 13 years old, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not fully grasping it because to me, I don't understand it. But the amount of racism that we, because we weren't going in there to trash the place, we were going to be just as great tenants as all the other little old ladies that live there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of that also has to do, and I'll always blame the media for everything because I think that a lot of it was, you know, put out there by what was happening in the Bronx, you know, how it was reported. I mean, the Bronx became national news.
Yes.
South Bronx, right?
Bronx was burning.
Right. We had Jimmy Carter, we had Ronald Reagan, and they didn't talk about the great places like Castle Hill. They didn't talk about Pelham Bay and Williams Bridge, Williamsburg, or where Bobby Watts was from. So, you know, a lot of that has, you know, to me, it's just that it gets put out and then people just kind of take that as like, oh, well, they're, you know, that's what happens when you have, you know, the Puerto Ricans living in there. That's what happens, you know, and then that kind of gets attached to us.
Walking around with that stigma. Even if I, you know, even moving out of the Bronx and moving into upstate New York and then people ask me, oh, where are you from? I'm from the Bronx. Oh, I had one person when I went to Florida once. I remember, I'll never forget this. One person, they asked me, oh, where'd you grow up in Florida? And I said, oh, I grew up in the Bronx. Oh, do you carry a gun? I mean, literally, this person asked me that right
and
to
you
my
said,
face.
Yes.
And I said, yes, then get away from me.
Right here.
So, you, again, it's that whole thing. You walk around. It's kind of with you when you're walking around.
I remember, I won't even say who because it's so stupid, but I remember somebody left their keys. They locked their car door.
Right.
And the keys. It was, I won't even say who it was because it'll open up who it was. A group of people that I know well, but it wasn't part of my family, but it was an attachment that I had to this group of people. And somebody, they left their keys in a car, you know, and they couldn't open the door of the car, you know. So I swear to you, they looked at me like, we can't get in. And they looked at me like, somehow I would have the skill to open up a car door and do the whatever they do when they stick the hanger
in there and everything.
And I was like, yeah, I don't know. What do you think? I got like a blade in my mouth. And I hold on.
I thought you took your shoelace out and did it with you.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't know how to do that. I've never done that. I've never stolen a car. You know what I mean? It's like, but I remember that feeling and it was just really hilarious. I mean, I never, you know, I was either naive or it just didn't affect me or I just ignored it or something or I just didn't feel it. But experience that type of racism like that. Like for me, it was I was living in a doorman building on the Upper West Side, and I think I might have told the story. But I was living in a door. It was a really nice building. Like Tina Fey was living there. This was like during a certain period of my life. And I was living in this beautiful doorman building. So one night I was coming home from work and I stopped off at the I don't know, Chinese restaurant or somewhere to get some food. And I had a bag and I had my food and I'm getting into the elevator And another guy gets in there, tall, white gentleman, well-dressed.
Right.
And he turns to me, he goes, oh, where are you bringing that to? So he thought I was the guy delivering the food. And immediately I picked it up and I was like, I'm bringing it to my house on the 11th floor. And he was like, oh, I'm sorry. And he was like, you can tell that he was just mortified, you know. But then again, here's the two sides of it. Is that racism or is that just knowing that most of the people that look like me deliver food? When I order food, guys that look like me delivered the food to me.
Right.
Is that racist? Is that no? Those are the guys that were doing the job.
Do you think it's a stereotype, really?
It's a stereotype. It definitely is a stereotype. But at the same time, you know, like he couldn't even fathom. You know right. what I mean? Like right. that I that you live, could actually in, live that building, in that
building.
Right. You know, in that building. So I get that part of it. You know what I mean? But that's part of the battle that we have and that we're still struggling with.
Well, it's part of
we
the battle
need to
of
elevate ourselves.
It's not only the battle of living from the Bronx, it's the battle of being Hispanic.
Hispanic. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't even like the word Hispanic because I don't like the word panic having to be in the word to describe me.
Drop mic.
So anyway.
Oh, okay. I mean, you know.
Yeah. So I mean that's part of the we're going over an hour now.
Holy cow.
Yeah, we've got a lot to talk about the Bronx, but yeah, I mean, I think that we'll do a part three.
This time it's personal.
Yeah. Oh God, the wrath of John. So, yeah, no, but I think that, you know, when you're talking about the Bronx, this is interesting though, because it does bring up a lot of other, not just our own music and our own philosophies and how we were raised, but it does also bring up sociological
yes.
conversations and the whatever stigma that you have because you were a Puerto Rican from the Bronx.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like I almost use it now as a badge.
Sure.
You know, as a badge of honor. Like sure. people say, yeah, I'm a Puerto Rican from the Bronx. You know what I mean? Right. Not only that, I'm a short Puerto Rican from the Bronx. You know right. what I mean? It's like and I like having that. I like saying where I'm from. I like saying that I'm Puerto Rican. I like saying that I'm from the Bronx, you know. Mm-hmm. But the reason I like saying is because I have a good thing going right now.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm happy. Mm-hmm. You know, I have beautiful kids. I have a good job. I have, you know, I have a career in other areas that I love. I make films. You know what I mean? I have music. I have I'm fulfilled.
Right.
So it's not so much. Had I not been fulfilled the way I am, or I had a different viewpoint, or maybe my awareness level wasn't where at the time, you know, I just didn't get it and I fell into traps or whatever. You know, teen pregnancy was a big issue. You know, I mean, somehow got into trouble early on and I got pregnant. Now, if I got, you know, well, it's 20.
These days it could happen.
Yeah. You know? But listen, if it happened to me at the age of like, let's say 16 or 17, it's a different life for me.
Yeah.
It's a different life for me, you know, because I was always irresponsible. I don't want to like diss that. I'd have to go out and get something that I don't want to do. I wouldn't have found my faith. I wouldn't have found music as much. I wouldn't have played with the band. There would have been a lot of changes in my life, right? So a lot of emotional things come into play. So that guy that didn't make it out, and by making it out, I don't mean make it out, because I know people that are in the Bronx that are very successful. They live in the Bronx.
Sure.
You know, you were living in the Bronx up to not that long ago, and you were That's successful. Right. You know what I mean? So it's not like I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about those guys that fell into traps,
right?
That made decisions based on popularity or money or status or something. They fell into the trap. Mm-hmm. They're not at the place where I am right now. What are they saying? They're the ones that are out there possibly doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Right.
And then, you know, just committing, you know, putting us behind,
yes.
you know, like, you know, and that to me is like, that's where it gets tricky. It's like, how do we get all of us to understand that we all are proud? You know, we are all descendants of people that died so we can be here.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? They gave up their lives fighting for land that was taken from them. you know, we got the Taino Indians in Puerto Rico. We have the Spaniards came in, you know, and did a number. We had Africans also brought in as well. So that is what a Puerto Rican makes. If you go to San Juan today, you'll see right in the center a huge statue, and it represents all those three, the Taino Indians, the Spaniards, and the African. So when you have this type of history, you know, but yet it's has this cloak of this negativity, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, this thing that's over it. But yet you have this rich history. I mean, we didn't even touch the food.
Right.
We didn't even talk about the dance. We didn't talk about salsa, the music. You know, we talked a little bit about it, but there's just so much of our culture that's just so incredible and rich, you know, that's beautiful. And I miss, you know, really being more involved in it. You know, I'm here mm-hmm. in Nashville, you know, my, you know, I don't have it a lot in my life. I do listen to a lot of the music. That's really where the challenge comes. So when we talk mm-hmm. about these shows about the Bronx, it's much deeper than just talking about the Bronx and our experience. It's like, how do we help? How do we increase our pride of where we were for everyone, no matter what you went through? Mm-hmm. You know, because I went through it. You know what I mean? I went through rough times. Yes, you know what I mean? And, you know, so, I mean, when I got out at the age of I think 24, maybe 25 or something. It was a culture shock
mm-hmm.
going from the South Bronx, middle of the South Bronx, to the Upper West Side where I lived.
Right.
You know, it was a culture shock. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe, you know, I had never seen that many white people. You know what I mean? We just didn't have them, you know, it just, that's just what it was. A white person usually was a teacher if you had them, you know what I mean? So there's a lot that we need to kind of, impinge. And I think George and I, our mission right now, you know, we're working on a lot of things. I don't know if anybody's still listening at this point, but if you are, thank you very much. We love you. But George and I are really on a mission to really want to help a lot of people. We want to be able to use what the gifts that we were given and really share them, you know, whether my gift of gab and my you know, music and film work and you know, storytelling, and George with his nutritional skills and his musical background and his ability to communicate. We want to be able to really put that together and create something that can really help people, and that's what we're doing. And we are working on something that hopefully either next year I'll be even optimistic and say next year, it could be 2 years, but we're putting something together that's going to be really for the purpose of really helping not only inner city, but people with cultures that are getting lost.
You're right.
You know what I mean? We need to like save these cultures. You know what I mean? TikTok is just destroying culture. You know, I mean, it's fine. Cause I work in social media. You know what I mean? And so I can't bash social media, but I use it to help, you know, I work for the council. I work for this homeless organization and we do a lot of great work there. You know what I mean? I also help our show. I also help my own personal content and my own personal brand. And it's always based on helping people and speaking the truth, whether it gets me in trouble or not, you know, it's part of the whole thing. Anyway, George, you want to say anything before we get out of here?
I mean, I think that's pretty much everything that needs to be said at this point, really.
But. Yeah. I think we want to thank everybody for tuning in. We will be back. We will do another one, a part three, and we'll just continue doing these. As a matter of fact, maybe you can cut this part out now, starting from now when we later on. We were actually, I don't know if everybody remembers, but I had a show. It was called JHS Show when I first started, and I interviewed a lot of people, and I did about 100 and something episodes of that. And those episodes were streaming on the Bronx Network. It's not really streaming. It's actually a network, a TV network. And it's in the Bronx, and it's called BronxNet. So just today, earlier today, I got an email from them that they're really interested in having us back, having the show back again, in a new form. So what we're going to do is we're going to package Counterparts, and you're going to be able to watch it in the Bronx itself, BronxNet. Our first two episodes will be these episodes that we did on the Bronx. We'll cut this part out. But no, actually, we'll leave this part in. Why not? Hey, BronxNet. So we're very excited about that. And that's going to be something that I really hope that we can go back and do a lot of work there in the Bronx and really influence people with. And we also have a broad palette. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we aren't going to only cover people that were from the Bronx.
Right.
We want to explore people's journey that can influence people that are in the Bronx as well as anywhere else that they consume it, you know, because we're all on the same, not the same journey. We're all on different journeys, but we all have a lot of the same obstacles that run in, that we run into: relationships, you know, food, housing, jobs, all those things. We all have to deal with those things. So that's why we do the show.
Agreed.
I'm going to shut up now because I'm going and going and going.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, folks, thank you very much. We want to thank you for watching. George Batista, John Henry Soto here for Counterparts. And we will see you again. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate y'all. And as always, peace.